Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Oh, boy.
I watched him collapse. We were just starting, and he just collapsed.
Imagine if that were, if you, like, I saw him die.
I heard Mantzoukas was on the guest on the episode. Yeah.
He really didn't want to talk to him, apparently.
Oh, no. He was saying beforehand how much he wanted to get out of that episode.
Well, we've started. Hi, this is the Three Questions. I'm talking to Jason Mantzoukas.
How are you, Andy?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
You are in your closet.
I'm in my closet where I've spent conservatively, the majority of the last year in this closet. Had I known that I was going to spend this much time inside of this closet, I would have changed things. I would have done things much differently.
And what if you weren't podcasting from your closet, would it be so neat?
It would be. I am a very cluttered person in that I've got a lot of stuff, but I'm pretty well organized.
And tidy.
Yes. I keep stuff. It's easy. I also, to be fair, inside of quarantine, I only wear essentially the same handful of things.
Yeah, me
so
too.
It's not like this is getting disrupted that much. I'm like down. I wear the same 8 shirts, pants, and underwears and socks, and I use the same, you know, probably 8 dishes, bowls, spoons, and glasses. And so it's like that's been my whole year.
See, I'm very much the same way. Although, like the socks, I think I've worn socks 3 times since been started. Just because,
you're one of those,
like,
barefoot boys.
No. I wear like kind of like slippery shoes.
See, but I also wear like comfortable house shoes. I wear like a Birkenstock clog.
Uh-huh.
But I wear socks with it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I wear socks with it. I don't like my bare feet like just walking around, being around outside. I don't like it.
I think you may be an NPR listener.
I'm on record. Now, I'm on record as both being an NPR listener and as being like a non-foot person, even my own feet. I'm like, hard pass. But you know what? Hey, listen, people are out there. They're running around. They're loving those feet. So, you know, more power to them.
Let them do it. Let them do it. People, you know, there's probably a lot of stuff I'm into that would make people very upset.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I'm just looking around your house and I'm just seeing so much of the erotic art you have hanging on your wall.
Erotic art, yeah.
And a lot of it seems to be you, paintings of yourself.
You know what? I never noticed that, but they do all look a lot like
me. Do you commission these? Do you commission erotic portraits of yourself?
I just, you know, I sort of describe what I want to, and it's all the same artist. It's my neighbor. Yeah.
I love the idea that your neighbor just like looks at you through your windows with like binoculars and just paints portraits of you from your normal life.
Right. Using his own feces. That's the real thing.
Oh, yeah. I forgot. Your neighbor is like super cool.
Yeah. So you are, I heard this from somebody that you've been home a lot. Like this pandemic has really sealed you in.
Yeah,
because
I shut it down. I shut it like March, I think 9th last year.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, I'd already been like, I'll be honest, pandemic is my like worst case scenario personally. Like, if everybody has their, some people are like, I'm afraid the plane I'm in is going to go down.
Yeah, or, yeah.
So an irrational fear, I'm going to be in a terrorist attack or whatever. Yeah. Pandemic is mine. So I was clocking COVID-19 even like at the end of 2019 when it was kind of, you know, moving around in Europe and Asia. So I was like, oh, fuck. And then we did a How Did This Get Made live in Vancouver at the end of February last year that I was like, should we cancel this show?
Yeah.
But we went, and just to travel internationally, like whatever it was, February 28th or something, was sketchy.
Yeah.
Just to be in the airport, just to be in the customs line, like already an enormous amount of people were wearing masks. And I was like, oh, fuck, I made a mistake. I should be at the very least wearing a mask. So I shut it down and have been pretty much, with the exception of like running a few, like I basically leave the house once every couple of weeks to run a few errands.
Wow.
Otherwise, that's it. You know, I go outside in my, like in my back, on my back porch.
Yeah.
But I don't like, I haven't been like hanging out in the backyard with somebody, with people, or, you know, we're all going to get together for a socially distanced, you know, like blah, blah, blah. No, yeah, I haven't done any of that.
Well, now, since this is sort of your phobic sweet spot, yep. Is there something about it that you're enjoying? Like, is it rewarding to you in some way?
You know what I don't know if it's rewards. Like, I would say in a very sad way, it's validating.
Yeah.
Because like all of the things that like in my mind, I'm very much like I was ready for it. You know what I mean? Like I had stuff ready to go. I got stuff I didn't have.
What does that mean? What does stuff mean?
You know, like masks and gloves and disinfectants.
And baby chicks.
yeah. No, I don't have that level of stuff. But I mean, like I felt like I didn't feel like a lot of people I know and friends of mine, I didn't feel like caught off guard.
Yeah.
You know, but I did and probably still do feel a much larger than normal people sense of dread and doom. Like,
oh,
I think
really?
There's a lot of people who are still have been able to see the light at the end of the tunnel, see the bright side, see, you know, like whatever. I'm like a real doom and gloom person on this front. Now, to answer your question a little bit, like there has been kind of wonderful elements of it. That I really am like, not exactly grateful for, but like, there is a way in which, and this is really a funny and weird thing. There is a way in which being stuck at home, trapped in my house, which by the way, I'm very lucky. I have a beautiful house. I can stay here and live and it's lovely. I have outdoor space that's private. That's very lucky. And I am still able to, as we are doing now, or as I do with How Did This Get Made, or I'm able to work from home to within a certain amount of what I do for work. So it is a luxury that I have been able to, like, not leave my house in a year in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But by being home alone this whole time has been a lot like, weirdly, a second childhood almost, where I feel stuck in my house. Like, I can't go out. And so it's been a year of, like, consuming a tremendous amount of content.
Oh.
A lot of it, like, stuff that, like, feels like I'm watching TV and movies and reading comic books. Also stuff that I did when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know? So there is a way that one of the positives has been, like, I feel very creatively inspired simply because I've been processing so much good stuff, you know, which has been kind of lovely to be able to be like, oh, I'm going to watch or rewatch all of, you know, Deadwood or the Fargo seasons. You know, or new stuff like Devs and Patriot and Lodge 49 or old stuff. Like I said, Deadwood or Sopranos or whatever. There is something quite nice about engaging with all of this stuff and kind of not having to obey or go along with all of the kind of what is normally a very busy life for me.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's like most of the year prior to this, I was on the road to some degree or another, either for work or touring the podcast or something like that. So there is a bit of, as to juxtapose a very busy, year, nomadic year, to have the exact opposite, a deeply isolated, alone year, though very stark, is kind of a weird, has been interesting and kind of, I don't know, satisfying in some way.
But lonely, I would think, you know?
Outrageously so. I would say my greatest struggle in all of this genuinely is just psychologically loneliness, you know, is just really not having touched another human being, you know, even for like a hug or to be close to someone else in a year is deeply unsettling, especially a year that's been very tumultuous, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Forget just the pandemic. It's like, also, you know, the state's on fire and the oceans are boiling and, you know,
and the lead up to the election.
Yeah. And there's, you know, and there's racists, you know, burning things in the street and attacking the Capitol. Chaos. Yeah.
No, there's there's been a lot of like very emotional stuff, a lot of stuff that I would have wanted to process with someone or with people that I would have processed at dinners with friends or with my family or whatever. So, you know, now I do all of that, you know, over Zoom with, you know, all those people, which again, like, great, you know, it's great that I can, you know, pop up and see all my family and my nieces and da 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 da. But there is definitely, it is not the same as being kind of soothed or comforted during tumultuous emotional upheaval by the presence of other people. You know, if that makes sense.
Do you have any pets?
I don't.
It makes a huge difference.
Huge. And I've already now been like going to a specific rescue organization's adoption page weekly now. So I feel like that is, I'm putting energy into that. I feel like it's only a matter of time.
Yeah. I have, I got a dog in August of 2019 and I like dogs and I wanted to get a dog, but it was also too, because being recently divorced, I wanted to just make it a little bit better for my kids, for my daughter specifically, like to have my, you know, I worked really hard to not have like a sad divorced dad apartment, like an apartment that's just like a couch and a TV and, you know, and socks laying around, you know?
No, and like TV dinners.
Yeah. So I got the dog, I mean, for myself too, because I wanted to have a pet. But with the pandemic here, and I mean, I still see my kids, so I have that, you know? Yeah. And now that I get to go to the Conan show somewhere, as opposed to just doing it at home, that was a huge difference.
I bet.
But the dog is a huge thing because,
because it really is like, it gives you that intimacy. It gives you that connection.
There's just another living thing there, you know, with you. So you're not alone.
Yeah.
And that's
absolutely. I think that would be gigantic. And I actually have had a couple of friends offer to like loan me their dog
just to
for the day or, you
for
know,
a
whatever.
Test drive. Like,
exactly. If you want, or just to spend time with their dog, just to have time spent, you know? Which is very sweet. I do think there is likely a dog in my future.
Good. Because, we can stop the podcast.
It's going to be your dog.
A dog.
I'm stealing your dog.
Yeah. Actually, I'm looking to get rid of this fucker. Jesus Christ. Annoying.
Oh, God. Yeah. I got this dog. I made a big show of it, so now I've got to keep it.
I can't just leave it somewhere because I'm on TV and someone will notice.
And I can't fight it. Nobody does that. We can't do that.
Yeah. Well, now you're one of three kids. Is that it?
No, two. I've got a sister. I've got a younger sister, who still lives East Coast. I grew up in New England. I grew up like suburban Boston. And my whole family lives in Boston. In and around Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Maine, you know, all New England.
And you were a drummer, or still are a drummer, right?
I was a drummer. I mean, I was like I studied drums. I was like I wanted to be a drummer. I was like in bands and in marching band and all that stuff. And I will say, during this pandemic year, I got an electronic drum set, and I've been playing drums a lot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's been like, that's another, again, like kind of weirdly, another throwback to feeling like I'm living a second childhood.
Yeah.
Which is, I just will go upstairs and play drums for an hour.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I bought all of the old, I repurchased all of the old like books, exercise books and practice books that I learned on.
Yeah.
So that I could kind of get, even I can still play drums fine. But right. like, I was like, no, there is, it's almost like when you learn a language and then you go to that country 20 years later and you're like, I understand what people are saying, but I no longer have the facility to speak it.
Right.
You know, and that's how I felt. I felt like my brain understood how to play drums, but my limbs were like, wait a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not sure I'm finding the right words.
Yeah.
So it's been fun to just kind of practice and play drums, and that's been kind of a blast, you know? Yeah. And also a good, like, I feel like I construct my days in blocks.
Yeah.
You know, exercise block, I got a Peloton. Great. Boom. Exercise block. You know, play drums. Boom. You know, whatever, you know, we're doing this now. Great. Okay. You know, everything is in like 60 to 90 minute blocks.
Right. Is that something that you have a natural facility for, or do you force that on yourself?
I force it on myself because okay. I am like otherwise my default is just amorphous mush.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just kind of like, you know, like kind of improvising my way through a day.
Yeah.
You know, so I have to really be proactive and be like, no, I'm going to do this and then this. Otherwise, I'll get nothing done.
Yeah. See, I have the problem because if I have a structure imposed on me, I get a lot more done.
Oh,
like
yeah.
And that's just kind of like the nature of me. You know, it's like the nature of, you know, as I've said many times, like it's not a coincidence that I'm a talk show sidekick. Sure. It's like I'm good at, well, what are you guys doing? Okay, let me pitch in. You know, let me do this. But like when I'm left to my own and, you know, hey, Andy, here's your day. Do whatever you want. I'm like,
get high and watch old Phil Donahue clips.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
Like, and that's like, no, that does not put brioche on the table.
That is exactly what I would do. You
yeah.
know? And that's what, frankly, in this last year, I've lost a lot of days to that. Lost a lot of days to, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get stoned and watch all the Harrison Ford movies from the 80s and 90s. You know? Or I'm going to watch, you know, like I've done like a lot of like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to watch all the Tony Scott movies that I like. Or I'm going to watch, like, I'll go through a director or go through a TV show or just like what you said, go down a YouTube wormhole.
Yeah.
If I'm going to watch every Joni Mitchell performance on talk shows, Dick Cavett show, this show and that show. Like, I'll just like get it all. I want to watch everything, you know, which I love. I love that, you know, and then you look up and 3 hours have disappeared.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
And it does get hard when you have kids and you're kind of like, you know, you really do need to get a structure to your life. And you need to, like, keep up with your work because, and then here I am, like, you know, pile of emails unanswered and yeah. like, you know, and especially now, you know, the Conan show on TBS is winding down and
yep.
I mean, truly nobody knows what's going to happen. So it's like, really, after, you know, 10 years of employment, as of June, I'm out of a job. It's what it seems like.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and I'm, you know, like everybody, all of Team Richter is like, you should develop something. I'm going to do that.
But it's that thing where it's like, that's not a muscle you've been exercising.
It's not at all.
You know, maybe at one time it was. And I wonder too, like, because we come out of similar backgrounds in terms of, you know, when we wanted to do comedy, we didn't go out and do stand-up, or at least no. I don't think you did.
I did
not.
You
know, like, you know, our thing wasn't, I should be the only person on stage, mm-mm. and it should all be about me. We
yeah.
both sought out ensemble-based comedy, support
yes.
group-based comedy, where it's not just me. I'm here making you look good. Theoretically, you're helping me look good. And it's not all about, like, I have to do every piece of this,
yes.
you know? And that's what in many ways, kind of what you're describing, you know, to be a sidekick or to be an improviser, to be somebody who is good in the ensemble is not necessarily the person who's like driving the bus,
yes.
you know?
No, it's, it definitely, it suited me very well because I was in film school. I was in Chicago. There's improv in Chicago. If I'd been in, I don't know, Milwaukee, or if I'd been in LA, I don't know that I'd ever would have done improv.
Oh, that's interesting. So you hadn't gone to Chicago.
No, I grew up there.
You grew up there and went to film school there.
Grew up there. I went to film school and I started working as a production assistant on television commercials.
Huh.
And then, you know, progressed in a freelance film production career on commercials, and I was doing props. I kind of ended up in props, like my, yeah. but then I started doing shows.
So at that point, you must be in your early 20s.
Yeah.
And then no 20s. Way, are you like somebody who like you, do you go to Second City as a fan, or are you like engaged in that world as a, like, are you turned on to that at all? Or is it like really an epiphany? Like you find it, you see it, and you're like that.
What happened was I was in film school. I had film school friends, funny friends. We'd shoot videos. I was doing film acting in film school because one component of film school is that nobody that wants to make short films in film school knows any actors.
Sure.
And if you're in one film and you can remember lines, people come to you and say, yeah. I'm doing a film. And which, it's really good experience, but ultimately, you know, I found that like a lot of weekends I was spending, you know, 12 hours at a forest preserve with somebody that didn't know what they were doing.
Of course.
You know?
Yeah.
And that got kind of frustrating. But a friend of mine started working at Improv Olympic with Sharna Helton and Del Close.
Is Del there at that point? Yeah.
He is. Yep. I took classes with Del.
Yep.
And she was doing this, and I thought, hey, you know, I went and saw her in some stuff, and I was like, oh, this is good. And the real key for me, because, you know, like in film school, I had a focus in screenwriting, but I'm a terrible writer. Not in like, I can write things, but sure. sitting down to a blank page is
yes.
ADD kryptonite. You know,
sure.
like I had trouble with it. So what was really important to me was the compromise of performing and writing and the immediacy of it. I couldn't think about it. I had yep. to do it. And so I didn't have a chance to second guess myself. I didn't have a chance to write a line and go, oh, that's stupid, and go back. I just was on stage with other funny people, which I mm-hmm. loved doing that. Like performing in show business is kind of secondary to getting to live and be with showbiz people.
Uh-huh.
I go to the Conan show and I'm with literally like some of the funniest people on earth.
Oh my God. Those writers, those producers, you know, since the beginning, you know, like have been some of the greatest,
yeah,
and continue to be some of the greatest comedic minds. You know,
yep.
it was just as like a, you know, my early New York UCB comedy days, you know, there was a fair amount of my, I think the first time I was ever on television, I believe, was in a sketch on the Conan show, the late night show. And then was on subsequently a number of sketches.
Yeah.
But there was like such an incredible thing to just being, when you were in a sketch, you got to be there all day.
Yeah.
And you got to watch the rehearsals of the other sketches, the other things, the notes on those sketches, how a sketch would go, you know, it would go up. You hear people get notes and see what was happening. And then they'd mount it again half an hour later with changes. And that was like super informative to like me, who at that point was just doing like Harold Night at UCB, was very kind of at the very beginning of doing shows and being a part of a group and all that stuff. It was fucking cool, you know, and super educational, I'll say.
And also too, for a lot of us, we were learning as we went, you know, like we, I mean, Conan had done SNL and Conan had done The Simpsons and Robert Smigel had done SNL and Robert Smigel had done The Simpsons. And that was it.
Yeah.
All of that was just, we had to make that up. Going out and doing remotes, you know, like Robert's, I did the first remotes and Robert's like, would you go do this at this event? And it's like, and all of a sudden, here's me from improv class out at like the Miss America pageant making comedy for TV and being like, I don't have any fucking clue. I don't,
That's amazing.
I'm just doing it. So,
yeah.
Well, we should. Okay, let's talk about you.
You know, my guest today, Andy Richter, one of the greats.
No, boy. I've got
five questions for him. You guys are fans
now
of the pod.
You studied religion.
I did.
You're a drumming religion guy. Like, and, you know, with a beard. Oh, my God, I can smell the patchouli from here. Oh,
my beard is bigger than it's ever been, I think, right now.
Now, tell me about that. You went to school and you studied religion, correct?
I did. I mean, you know, this is now, you know, so long ago. But yeah, I went to like a kind of traditional liberal arts college. I went to Middlebury College in Vermont.
When was this? What year?
I graduated in 95.
Okay.
So this is, I was, you know, I went in 91. So right around, so in that mid, like early 90s, I spent in college, you know, the Nirvana Smashing Pumpkins years.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, it's like, it was, so it was a, I was a like a comparative religion department. It was not like a theological school or anything like that.
Right.
I didn't study religion thinking I was going to be a priest or anything like that. I studied religion in the sense that I studied all of the world's religions, and that's kind of what it was about. And it was, I found it, it was very interesting, and I found it very compelling. And it just so happened that my school had a very good department.
Mm-hmm.
So the classes were great. It didn't come from like a personal passion or anything like that. I just kind of kept liking the classes and liking the professors.
Mm-hmm.
So kept doing more. If I'm being honest with myself, like at a certain point, I had more credits in that department, so I was like, I might as well major in this.
Oh, okay.
Because what I really spent, I would say the majority of my time doing, was the comedy group that I was in and the radio station that I ran.
Oh, okay.
Those were the two. If I could have majored in the comedy group or the radio station, absolutely I would have. But
I see.
You know, it was, and the things that were close to that, like there was no communications department at Middlebury, and the theater department at the time was okay, but not great enough that I wanted to like dig myself into that, you know?
Right.
So
right now there's somebody, a Middlebury grad from that time, a theater grad, who's like, fuck you.
Oh yeah. I'm going to tell those professors that you slagged them
you
off.
Said that. When I get off work from Starbucks.
Because it's a British person who says
slagged them off. Well that, so you knew, you were kind of like, in your head, what are you going to do with yourself? I mean, are you, what do you
think? In my mind, I was either going to be a drummer or a comedian.
Uh-huh.
You know, like at that point, I was playing in bands, but I was also in an improv group.
Right.
While I was in college, when I arrived, there was a short form group that was like a, you know, traditional improv short form games.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was during my period there, one of our, Rodney Rothman. Do you know Rodney Rothman?
I know the name, and I
he was a Letterman writer, and he He was one of the writer and directors of Into the Spider-Verse a couple of years ago. He's like, I'm certain you've met him along
Probably.
The way.
Yeah, yeah.
I went to college with him. He was in the same comedy group with me, along with Jessica St. Clair and some other folks. And he, during one summer, got a hold of Truth in Comedy. The book,
Sharna's book. Sharna Halpern from Improv Olympic.
Exactly, who you mentioned earlier when you were monopolizing this interview with your background and how you came up in comedy. Jeez.
Look, you asked me, Jared.
So he brought back that book, and that book had a description of long form, obviously, long form improv, and specifically the Herald.
Yeah.
So a group of us from our larger improv group splintered off and started a second group, which was a Herald team, doing Heralds to the book. We'd never seen it done before.
Yeah, yeah.
But we did it because it was described in the book. So,
yeah.
But it was like, when I think about it now, I get like so uncomfortable because we would perform instead of in like the big assembly hall where we did our short form shows that could fit a couple of hundred people, we would do Heralds in the coffee shop, which was a cool, small setting.
Yeah, yeah.
The show would be like an hour, and we would strictly adhere to what they outlined in the book. So the pattern game, the opening was a pattern game, which is a free associative kind of improv formatted kind of way to get out a bunch of information quickly. So it's,
frequently used as a warm up.
Yes.
Yeah.
But we did it as like, we did it for probably 10 to 15 minutes of like breakfast, pancakes, Captain Crunch, like at this pace. I think about those audiences and I'm like, they must have been miserable. We were terrible.
Yeah,
but it was electric. It was so exciting. I loved it. I loved improvising. I found it very much scratched the same itch that I got performing in bands, but I liked being on stage in an ensemble of comedians better because there was no perceived hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were all in it together.
There's rather no than man. Yeah.
Yeah. Rather than there being like exactly songwriters or front men and I'm just in the rhythm section or anything like that. There really was like improvising felt like being in a jazz band or something. It felt like we're all feeding off of each other. We're all kind of riffing and in such an important part of improvising on stage, both whether you're playing music or doing comedy, is about listening.
Mm-hmm.
And those were already kind of skills that I'd built up a little bit. So I felt like a little bit like I had a little bit of like a history there. So mm-hmm. it was very easy for me to get into improvising comedically. And I was and still am like obsessed with it. You know, like I still do in normal times. You know, here in LA, I still do like 2 to 3 shows a week at UCB, you know?
Wow. That's something. It's admirable to me because doing just straight up long form improv, it's stressful. And like, I don't leave the house to go get stressed out. I leave the house to go have fun.
Yeah.
And it is fun.
But if you're out of the, it is, I always liken it to, it's a muscle that you have to keep exercising.
Yes, absolutely.
Otherwise, it's the equivalent of if I right now was like, you know what I'm going to go do? I'm going to go play a full soccer game.
Yeah.
Like I would 100% be injured in 10 minutes.
Absolutely.
I haven't played soccer in years, you know? I used to be good at it. I used to feel very comfortable playing soccer, but not anymore.
Mm-mm.
So
yeah.
To me, it's the same thing. Part of the reason I love improvising so much is I've been doing it consistently nonstop.
Yeah.
You know, this is the longest, this year is the longest I've ever gone not getting on stage and improvising. And in many regards, I've been improvising with some version of the same, like 30 people for years, you know, mm-hmm. like my Herald group that existed in New York existed for 9 years. The group that I've been doing a show with here for 10 years is pretty much the same group of people. Like there's like the people that I did ASCAT with, those casts, there's so much overlap. So I'm also like, it's also like hanging out with my friends.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like the equivalent of people who have like a regular card game or something, except ours is like, we do a show on stage and then we go have dinner and catch up. And it's like quite lovely.
See, I also just kind of, even in the early days, I like the hanging out part way better than the doing shows part. And so like funny. I said, you know, we go to Largo and we do a show, and doing the show now is like, it's so weird and so kind of short and truncated, and there's only so much we can do.
Sure.
A lot of like, well, we've got a new sponsor who answers that question. And then there's like a tape that we can't see.
Sure.
You know, but the fun part is the fucking around. And there's so many times
the bits.
When we're just sitting bits. Around. Yeah. And just like Conan being mean to people, mm-hmm. like just being, but in a fun, you know, like in a funny way, like he plays like his off screen persona bit character that he's been doing for years is the genius surrounded by incompetence.
Sure.
You know, and so it's, you know, like a Mr. Burns kind of almost without the voice. And he's so fucking funny doing it. And he's so observant and so quick and like, like something that happened 10 years ago, he'll remember it and bring that's it up great. And it'll be like, oh man.
But that's also like testament to the fact that like your show is also a show that has had people that have been around 10, 15, 20 years. Like it's not like your show has a tremendous amount. I mean, there's certainly turnover, but there's something kind of lovely about how consistent the voice of the show is, both because it's Conan, but also because you're there, because Sweeney's there, because so many people who have been there for so long are still there.
Absolutely. You know? And I mean, you know, there's people who have like kids out of college who have only worked for Conan O'Brien.
Yeah.
Like that was their first job in television. And that's where they've worked the entire time. And that's not,
rare.
Yeah,
that's
it's very rare. It's very rare, and it's very nice. And there's people on that show that feel like family to me. You know, like literally like cousins or, you know, yeah.
Well, I mean, you really have. You've spent all, look at this, like this won't really exist anymore, really. Things like this. Like this is no shade to the current crop of talk show hosts, but I don't think Jimmy Kimmel is going to want to be around in another 15 years doing his show. You know? I think he wants to be doing other stuff in a way that I think is, you know, like, I don't know that like a career in late night talk shows having the kind of longevity that you guys have had is in the cards anymore.
No, I don't think
you
so
know?
Either.
I don't even know if late night talk shows are in the cards much longer, you know?
Yeah. Well, it is. Yeah, you're right, because, well, everything's changing. That's like a whole different, like head spinning conversation of, like, what's TV going to be? And, you know, I mean,
when you free it from time, right? Because your show, all these shows were Colbert, Kimmel, Fallon, Seth, all of these are the last shows. And then you could say the Today Show, Good Morning America. These are the last shows that are tethered to time, to the times that they're on, right?
Yes.
Everything else just exists freestyle.
Yep.
You know, like, but they, with the exception of sports, I guess. If you want to watch the game, you got to watch it when it's on. You can't just, because otherwise you're going to find out you're going to get spoiled.
Yeah.
You know, for sports. But, you know, I'm not a sports person, so that doesn't impact me. But those two poles, the morning shows and those late night shows, are the only things that are still really tethered to a time that they come on.
Yeah.
And feeling like, I got to watch that. It's at the end of the day. And people have their host that they feel, you know, is their favorite or speaks for them or gets their point of view or their sense of humor or whatever. I think all that goes away. I don't think your kid, I was going to say my nieces, but your kids to that age, I don't think any of them give any shits
about those
kind of shows that happen at the end of the day as a way to wrap up the day's events.
They're
processing the day all day long on the phone.
And it's already happening. Like people aren't, you know, what's a really good rating for Colbert or Fallon or Kimmel now is an awful rating from 10 years ago.
Yeah.
10 years ago, if you'd getting the rating that they're getting now, it would be like, oh my God, what are you doing on the air?
Yeah.
Because there's just not many people doing that anymore.
Oh no.
They don't. I don't watch them, but then again, that's for me. It's different for me.
But the weird thing is, if anything, people like us should be like older people should be the people that are like, yeah, of course I still watch, Colbert. Of course I still watch The Tonight Show,
yeah,
or whatever is your show. Of course, that's how, you know, like somebody laughed at me recently because I told them I have cable. And they were like, wait, you actually still pay for cable?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, wait a minute. Have things tipped now so hard that to still have cable is preposterous? And the answer was yes. It is perceived of as something only for old people.
Well, sorry.
I know.
It's over. No,
that ship has sailed.
And I still watch TV and it kind of bugs my kids. I put on the TV and then on the guide and flip around and see what's on. And that's,
you discover great stuff.
Yeah. Or just whatever. Honestly, there is still, and it still matters to me, someone else is playing that somewhere.
Yes.
I am making a connection to someone in real time. Like, yep, whether it's just somebody put on pushed a button on a computer that made, House Hunters, yes, International play at this particular moment. But this is happening right now.
Well, to speak to that exact point, it feels like you are living present tense.
Yes.
Like I'm discovering this other thing that's happening right now as well. We both, me and this show, are living in at this moment in time. Not like me calling up anything I want to watch because I can. That seems like a closed circuit, Yeah. It's just me deciding right now I want to watch Letterkenny on Hulu or whatever, So I'm going to watch it and I'm going to love every episode because it's absolutely genius and hilarious. But there is something wonderful about flipping through channels and catching on Nat Geo some show about a guy who's like, I'm going to, using only primitive tools, I'm going to survive in the pre-Saharan desert for a week. And I'm I want to watch this.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have known this, but let me see.
Yeah. Or like, the giant monster fish that roamed early, prehistoric waters. Like, okay. Oh,
This is just dad TV.
Oh, it's all dad stuff.
Dad TV talk. You with your ancient monsters and me with my survival shows.
My daughter insult. She's like, she was talking about, it was some like kind of domestic drama movie, like some sort of, poignant family story that touched on truths. And I was like, no, thanks. And she's like, well, I'm sorry that it isn't Braveheart 2. And
oh
I'm
my
like,
God.
What is that? And she goes, that's all you watch is stuff like that. And I'm like, that is not true.
It is not true. But Braveheart 2 is a great pitch.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
But I'm the same way with radio. I flip through, I listen to MSNBC, I listen to Howard, I listen to one of my favorites on SiriusXM is the old-timey radio shows.
Sure.
Like, I love listening to these old radio mysteries, with the old commercials. It's like, talk about old man shit.
This just went to a whole other level. Yeah. You know what I love? I love the old radio dramas where you can really hear the Foley work. I mean, sad.
I just like, to me, it's like I like stories. Like, I like if I got to drive at night and it's like, I don't want to listen to a whole audio.
You
want to
turn on the radio and have it be like, whoo, whoo, whoo.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's enough, Lorraine. I've had enough from you.
Precisely.
What are you doing with that gun? Oh, no.
Love that shit. I love that shit because, and also too, I just love like there's things like whenever I've noticed, and then, like, whenever anybody says, like, Wilbur, I want a divorce. Like, that woman's going to die. Like, once you say, like, I want a divorce, or Wilbur's going to die. Like, one or the other of them You can't mention divorce on an old-timey radio show.
In the olden days is not allowed. Somebody or both have to die.
Yeah,
they have to be punished for that transgression.
I actually had an idea. I had an idea for a movie script that was set, and it was bigger than just this, but it just happened to be set in like the old time radio world. Yeah. And I told it to my agent, and he's like, "I don't think anybody wants to see that." Like, okay,
it's so true.
Thank you for the honesty. Yeah, because it's like westerns. Nobody wants to see westerns. There's fucking great westerns that get made, and no one sees.
Nobody's
them.
Interested in westerns.
Yeah,
I think our version of westerns now is superhero movies.
Yes.
You know, like superhero movies are, for all intents and purposes, because westerns in that for the previous generation, from the TV westerns like Rawhide and Bonanza, the pulpy kind of westerns, to like the, you know, John Ford,
you know,
incredible, beautiful, you know, tremendous cinema, John Huston, John Ford, like those westerns, Nicholas Ray. And then you get into like the Sergio Leone. There's so many different versions of westerns, all the spaghetti westerns, all that stuff. That's kind of, you know, this is maybe going to sound ridiculous, but that's kind of what's happening now with superhero movies.
No, absolutely. They're formulaic escapes. You know, it's the same thing. Like, I love samurai movies and they're all the same sort of elements. You know, it's like Mexican food. There's about 8 things and you mix them up in different ways and you get 12 different dishes. You know, I mean, it's.
Yeah.
And there's something satisfying about that on a very like biological level. We obviously like that.
Yes.
We like coming back to slightly different versions of something we've seen before.
Well, there's also like, I mean, I think there's also a finite number of stories and how we tell them is what's interesting.
Yes.
You know, and so, and I think the same thing with songs.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that I think that it's that like there, you know, like everybody does a love song. I just happen to love the love songs from the artists I love the most because they speak to me. But that doesn't mean all those other bands and love songs, like people who like the Eagles, a band that I legitimately despise.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, great. I like that you like the Eagles because they resonate with you. They do not with me, but that's fine. And that's kind of what it is, I think, is everybody kind of has a different in. I think everybody's taking inspiration from the same kinds of stories and then putting them out into the world. And everybody, we especially live now in a world where so much stuff is being pushed at us, like an overwhelming amount of content between music and TV and film and like, you know, and then also not to mention social media and like stuff that is now on our screens, whether it's TikTok or Snapchat or in the past Vine or things, small platforms that were also places where creative people could kind of put stuff up that was whatever, funny, informative, whatever version of it. They're now people are able to curate a playlist of all of these elements that hits their sweet spot.
Yeah.
You know, there is no longer or very little is there every single person watched MASH last night.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever, you know, whatever.
It's, or like Happy Days.
Sure.
It's the number one show on TV. Try and watch a fucking Happy Days.
Oh my God. And when you think about the fact that like, you know, on a weekly basis, like 50 million people watched Happy Days every
week
compared to like an episode of Parks and Rec that, you know, or 30 Rock where they got like a million people to watch it. You know?
Yeah.
And that is such a wide gap.
Yeah.
You know, we're just in an environment now where it's like, so the audiences for everything are so small so that when something does break through, like a Game of Thrones or something that feels like it has some stab at creating a monocultural experience that everybody is like around the water cooler kind of talking about it. Those are now what used to be very ordinary parts of our week, kind of sharing our thoughts about the show we all watch, has now turned into like, we're all watching different. Everybody's trying to, instead of everybody being like, did you see blank last night? Everybody's trying to turn each other on to the shows they like.
Yeah.
That they assume nobody else knows about.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what do you want to do with the rest of your career?
You know, I want to keep running this podcast. I want to keep, you know, I feel like I've got another couple of years doing this show.
Right. Which is all just getting people to know me.
Yes.
Yep.
Do you know Andy? Yep. How well do you know Andy? You know, I'll say, like, I'm pretty happy with my career, with the exception that this year was a real step back.
This year just is a fucking wild card that throws everything off.
Yeah, exactly. But, like, I feel really, but, like, even to that point, like, even inside of a year in which I have not set foot on a set of any kind, I haven't worked on camera in any way, I've still been able to do, like, a tremendous amount of work, whether mm-hmm. it is animation voiceover that I've been able to do from home, or whether it is the podcast, the How Did This Get Made podcast that I host with Paul Scheer and June Diane Raphael, or mm-hmm. being a guest on your podcast or other people's podcasts. That's in and of it. It's not like this is a career. I don't make money off of this, but there is certainly something very satisfying about participating in these conversations that I enjoy, you know, and that I see as part of work, I guess, you know? And the fact that podcasts, you know, my podcast has now been around for 10 years. That podcasts have, inside of that time, gone from, like, you know, when we started our podcast, I gave it the same weight that I give a show at UCB, frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, oh, we're going to do this show. It's going to be fun. I'm going to talk to Paul and June and someone else, and it's going to be a blast. You've been on it. It's a chat amongst friends. You know, right. Maybe we do it live at Largo or someplace else, or maybe it's just in the studio with us. It's great fun. To now, just, you know, we did a live stream of our podcast over the course of the pandemic and sold something like 10,000 tickets.
Wow.
Which blew my mind. I was like, this podcasts now reach a level of audience that is wild and incredible. And so that's really a huge component of, like, what I really like about my career is that, like, I get to do the podcast and reach people that way. I get to get up on stage and do improv and improv shows and exercise that muscle. I still write and sell scripts and develop stuff that sometimes gets made and sometimes doesn't. Under normal circumstances, I get to perform on some of the shows that, you know, that I absolutely love, many of which mm-hmm. I was a fan of before I even got an opportunity to be on them. So I think a lot of it is keep moving that ball down the court or whatever. Yeah. I want to keep, you know, like, I like, my career has been all about, I feel like, incremental progress. Mm-hmm. I'm not, like, trying to dunk, you know, I'm just trying to
keep. And that was never, like, you didn't set out thinking, like, I'm going to be on SNL and then I'm going to be the star of movies.
I did think that. When I moved to New York, I was very arrogant in this, in the sense that I was like, oh, I'm going to be on SNL in, like, 3 years.
Yeah.
And that was not the case, you know?
I never saw you on there.
No, you never. Yeah. No, never. I couldn't. No, the two shows I wanted to be on very deeply, like, from childhood, SNL, you know, just because it was so much of my first exposure to sketch comedy and and especially during years when those casts were strong.
Yeah.
You
know? And if you're a particular kind of person with comedy ambitions and they are of a particular kind, that's the place to go.
You know, absolutely.
Because they're, you know, Kids in the Hall isn't hiring, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. There are very few. And when I was growing up, there wasn't Mad TV. There wasn't In Living Color. There weren't other sketch shows that had a revolving cast. I mean, Fridays, there was Fridays, but it was short lived.
You know,
but so really SNL felt like both a comedy institution, but also like a continuing concern.
Yeah.
It wasn't like it felt like it was something meaningful from the past, but also still relevant at the present tense.
Right.
And then also when I moved to New York and was coming up, happened to coincide with the rise of The Daily Show, with Jon Stewart taking over The Daily Show and turning that into an incredibly relevant show. And I really was gunning for one of those kind of correspondent roles.
Yeah.
On that, but I could never get really any traction with either show, frankly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I came in really hot and arrogant thinking that's how I'm going to get this. But very quickly was d- disavowed of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then it just became the work of, you know, genuinely, I feel very lucky. Like, I started UCB at the beginning, so had years in which I just was able to get better, do shows, write shows, put up shows, like that kind of Malcolm Gladwellian 10,000 hours, because the UCB scene was so kind of in its nascency, we were able to kind of get stage time. We were able to, like, just do shows, tear them down, put a better version of it back up without people really looking. Yeah. You know, it was years before agents or managers ever came and saw us. It was, yeah. we were just running around for years, you know,
just making shows,
stuff. And that was very, I feel very lucky that we got that time, mm-hmm. you know, because I think we got to do stuff and get better while no one was looking. Versus now, I think, you know, there's just such a sense of immediacy, you mm-hmm. know, like, I don't know that people coming up in these scenes get a chance to be bad for a while and get better without people looking, or without, now people are putting everything they do online and everything then lives forever. And it's like, there's a period in which, like, you have to get better. You have to, like, you know, and that that is what I feel like. Those years are the years that I feel very nostalgically for, mm-hmm. the years where we were just doing bad shows and then going to the bar afterwards and being like, why did that not work?
Yeah.
You know, why does this show, like, we did a show, Besser directed me and a bunch of other people of my generation in a show. The show was meant to be so in Chicago, they had done the movie form, you know, which was an improvised movie.
Yeah.
So you improvise both the plots and the characters of an archetypal kind of rom-com or action movie.
You're right.
But then you also have all the lexicon of, like, we fade in and you do the filmic language as improvisers on stage. So he wanted to do a similar thing in New York where we were doing, but it was all animated, like, Saturday morning cartoons.
Yeah.
So he wanted to do, like, an improvised cartoon show. So it was poppy, bright colors and crazy, and it never worked. It was very hard. We couldn't crack it.
Yeah.
And we would go up every week and just eat shit. And what was, but it, I recognize it now as, like, one of, like, the most influential years of my comedic growth, both because it was such a hard show to figure out and how hard we worked to try and figure it out.
Right.
Like, how comfortable we got at failing was so important, but also, like, how we would continue to kind of try and fix it and come at it from this. And what if we just redid it this way, or looked at it through this lens, or what if it had a macro structure that we could kind of keep coming back to? Like, all of that stuff, we never wound up with a functional show.
Right.
But the process of doing it made us all way better improvisers, way better, you know?
And you also then learn the lesson of quitting. Okay, this isn't going to work.
This isn't going to work. You know, there's just something in here that is kind of, like, impossible to kind of land.
Yeah.
Which is fine, because that's the nature of an improvised show, I feel like, is sometimes the idea is unexecutable, but is itself compelling.
Yes.
You know, the show was, we were funny. We were funny people being funny on stage. But, like, the movie format, the thing we were kind of always chasing, was so satisfying to watch as an audience. Yeah. It was it was an incredibly powerful and satisfying form.
Right.
And we were always chasing that level that at the end of the show, people wouldn't be just like, oh, that was funny. But they would be like, wow, that was cool.
Yeah.
You know,
it felt like a complete thing. And we saw it.
Yes.
We saw its birth and, you know, its existence. Yeah.
Yeah. We saw them build something out of nothing. And, like, it became like a magic trick.
Yeah.
Versus, I think we always ended up with a pretty funny show that was maybe not quite as great as it could have been.
Yeah.
But the process of doing it really, the process of doing it and failing at it really made us all very good improvisers, which I think is something that I don't know that people are allowed to do as much anymore, which is get up and fail a bunch.
Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of thing that we got to do a lot of in, like, the early days, when I was coming up.
Yeah. Well, Is there anything like, is there any kind of ongoing disappointments, you know, like things that you wish you'd done differently or done better or like,
you know, it's interesting. I think I'm of the opinion that I think because I'm pretty pleased with where I am, I have to acknowledge that my failures were part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like there are certain projects, like pilots that I wrote that didn't get produced. I was at the time devastated,
yeah.
You know, because it would have been a game changing move in my career at that point,
absolutely.
Which was I wasn't acting at all. I was like a medium successful writer. Like I was, so I'd sold scripts. I'd developed a couple pilots. Like I was at the beginning of a writer's career. Mm-hmm. And had that show gone, I think it really would have triggered a level of success or a potential level of success that would have been transformational for me in that moment, like 2009, 2010 type of time. But had it been successful, I suspect I would not have become an actor, really. I would not have been available to be on The League or Enlightened or those first couple of shows that really kind of put me into the world as an actor, where people then started to see those shows and be like, oh, I want to use you on Modern Family, or I like you on that thing. All of those things, I likely wouldn't have been given those opportunities because I would have been doing my other thing. So I really like my career. So even the mistakes or the things that I look back on now and I'm like, oh, should I have moved to LA earlier? Or like all the kind of things that could have gone differently, I kind of am like, no, I'm comfortable with them. Even the disappointments, even the heartbreaks, the missed opportunities, the things that I poured, you know, blood, sweat, and tears and years of time into developing pilots and shooting pilots and writing scripts that don't get made and all that stuff is devastating. But all of it kind of was necessary to get me here, and I kind of like being here. So I don't mind it. I don't look back. I don't really have regrets, or I don't look back feeling like, oh, if only this, or oh, if I'd only gotten that. I wish I'd gotten that part in.
Yeah, yeah.
If I should have gotten that part in The Office, or whatever. All the things I auditioned for and didn't get.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like, but I. It's not. That's not. That wasn't what was happening. You know.
Yeah.
So I'm very grateful for the fact that inside of those failures or missed opportunities or whatever, I continued to build and make stuff on my own. You
and
know?
Exist. And, just exist. Yeah.
And always having, I will say, as a safety or as a thing, there was always something about knowing that I could still and would still be getting up on stage, writing shows, improvising shows at UCB was like, always made me feel like that part was always going, you know, like I never was reduced to nothing. You know, I always still had that avenue, which I found and still find very rewarding, you mm-hmm. know, and very compelling. Like I still love doing shows and love that I can still do shows. And so if my TV script doesn't get produced, that's a super bummer. It's a lost year in a lot of ways, but almost always I look back on those things and it brought either somebody into my life who then later hired me to work on something else, or I still work with in some other capacity. I don't know. I don't look back with too much kind of like regrets or bad feelings about any of it.
Right.
If that makes sense.
I wish I had like a clip package of all your failures just so I could run it right now.
Oh my God.
Not you mean not this?
Oh, know? What about yeah? Oh my yeah, God! Yeah. It would be so long. All of the pilots that I wrote that didn't get produced. All of the pilots I wrote that did get produced that didn't get picked up the series.
Yeah.
I mean, come on! It's like, you know, it's
also footage from like bad relationships and things.
Oh,
like,
okay.
Where you hurt people's feelings.
Wait, is this the part where you just play clips from ex-girlfriends who are like,
yes, exactly.
What a piece of shit.
Now that's a podcast. Submarining somebody with their exes. Mm.
Oh,
I got to cut that out of here.
Wait, why are you making a note?
Submarining exes. And I'm, you know, later that I'll just think like, I wanted to do a show about submarines? What?
Yeah, why did I, what is this?
Well, Jason, thank you so much.
What a delight, Andy.
It's been wonderful. Yes, you are one of the, you know, now one of the cavalcade of Greeks I've had on the show.
Oh, nice.
You've got your Galifianakis, yeah. Your Palamedes.
Okay.
Two Sidereae, as they're
great.
Called. Yeah, yeah.
Great.
And you.
And me. Great.
That's a lot of
Greeks.
I mean,
you're the only people you're missing, I believe, are Dimitri Martin and Nia Vardalos.
Oh, all right. I got to get people booking them right away. Right away. Telly Savalas is dead, so I can't.
I mean, yeah, and yeah. You can interview half of Tina Fey and half of Jen Aniston.
Yeah, you're right.
You can do mini episodes with each of them.
Well, Jason Mantzoukas, thank you for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Andy Richter. I appreciate it.
I look forward to you leaving your house and actually being able to see you out in the world.
What a delight. It's always a delight to run into you in the world. So I look forward to the next time it can happen.
Me too. And you out there, you come back next week and listen to more of The Three Questions. Goodbye. I've got a big, big
love for you. The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It is produced by Lane Gerbig, engineered by Marina Pais, and talent produced by Galitza Hayek. The associate producer is Jen Samples, supervising producer Aaron Blayert, and executive producers Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts. Can't you tell my love's a growing?
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.